Good afternoon and welcome to House Labor and Commerce for Wednesday, February 21st. It is 3:21 p.m. Members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Knopf, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Wool, and myself, Chair Kito. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our recording secretary this afternoon is Susie Edwardson. Our LIO moderator is Max Stanley. Today we have a presentation from three individuals on Alaska's economy and entrepreneurship. We also have a follow-up second hearing on House Bill 306, PERS-TERS distributions, that I am hoping we have the time to be able to hear and move forward. And then following this meeting at 4:45, we do have our Department of Revenue subcommittee meeting, and I do believe we are considering closeouts this evening. And then I do believe we have, do we have another one after that?
Yeah,
Department of Labor at 5:30. So hopefully we can get all that done and get over to the Filipino So first up today, we do have Dan Robinson with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development Research and Analysis Division, who's got a little presentation for us on Alaska's employment and our population statistics. And Dan, good to see you. Welcome to House Labor and Commerce.
Thank you.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and provide us with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair Kito. Dan Robinson, I'm the research chief at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And as my first slide shows, we're going to talk a little bit about employment and population. For those of you who aren't familiar with research and analysis, we produce, with federal partners, most of the economic data that you see related to jobs, unemployment, wages, population. Others then take that data, repackage it, analyze it, do other things with it, which we're thrilled about. We want it to have a long life. We want it to be analyzed. I was glad to see that Musin is on the agenda today, because ICER is one of the most sophisticated users of our data. They use other data besides ours, but Scott Goldsmith, Gunnar Knapp, and now Musin, lots of important analytical work. And we are not terribly sophisticated with our modeling. We're nuts and bolts. We produce the bricks. We do a little bit of analysis. We write articles. We do reports. But our main function is producing those bricks. And really key to our reason for existing in state government is objectivity. If you can't trust us, we're not much use to you. There's lots of information out there. Our information doesn't change with a change of governor or anything like that. That's very important for how you think of us. And I would encourage you, if you see bias anywhere in our stuff, call us on it. We'll look at it. So jumping in, first things first, and let's see. So what can you see?
We do have a screen right down below.
Okay, as long as you can see. I can explain more if you... That's what I wonder, our screen size. Presentation, right? Okay, great. So I have heard two things. One, the recession is over, and two, we're in a downward spiral. Neither one are true. And this chart is meant to get at that. So this shows our best, and it's very good information, very reliable, very near final through September. Through September, and almost certainly through December, Alaska continues to lose jobs. We lose jobs at a lower rate than we did at the worst part, which is roughly mid-year 2016. But we do continue to lose jobs. If you count those bars in the negative, it's 27.
Representative Sullivan Leonard, question.
Hi, through the chair. You'd asked us to point out something if it's glaringly kind of sticking out there. So I'm looking at June from this year compared to June from last year, and that's a significant difference. Can you explain maybe a little bit on why that's so vast?
Through the chair, Rep. Sullivan Leonard. So, and thanks for the reminder as well to orient ourselves a little bit. This is over the year change in employment. So it tells where we were in the bar you're looking at of June 2017 compared to June 2016. So we were that month, and that month very much got our attention when we saw it, because it starts to look like, hey, good summer. And it was a good summer. You've seen some of the data for tourism. Fishing is always up and down a little bit. There are things to like happening in our economy. But what that essentially means is that we almost matched year-ago June levels. Then July, August, not so much, right? And several times during this period of economic downturn, we thought we've seen that we're almost back to zero, almost back to job growth, and that was one of them. But through September, again, with a lot of certainty, we are well below year-ago levels. Not alarmingly so, but so did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. We've got a question from Representative Bull and then Representative Birch. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Me too.
I was waiting for him. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I understand, this is taking a month and comparing to the same month of the previous year, correct?
Correct, Representative Bull. Through the chair, that's generally how we make comparisons in Alaska, because we're so seasonal, right? If you compare May with March, for example, it's always going to be up. If you compare December with September, it's always going to be down. So that's kind of our, and there are other ways to do it, but to control for seasonality.
Sure, thank you. And a quick follow-up. So just on a overview, obviously there's big spikes. Looks like every 4 or possibly 5 months. So it's not a annual thing. And I'm sure you'll get to this. Is that a cyclical thing? Or is it just happenstance?
Yeah, no, these numbers are fairly small, so I wouldn't read too much into the month-to-month variation. More importantly, though, once it went negative, it stayed negative. When it goes positive, it will likely stay positive.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to understand your chart here. And so if I look at this, there's about 27 bars that are below where identified job losses per month or 27 months starting in whatever that is,
October
of 15. So are those cumulative losses? So
no.
So how do I read it from 1 month to the next? Because it says job losses. Over the year change, I'm just trying to understand if those are all below the bar. Does that mean I can calculate like 5,000 jobs times 27? That's how many jobs.
No, that's a good question, Representative Birch, through the chair. This is not cumulative. There are ways to do cumulative losses, and it's about 12,000 now. But this, looking at it this way, doesn't allow that.
So what is it then?
It's telling you the duration of job loss, and it's giving you an idea of severity. And there will be there are a couple of charts later on that will help flesh that out a little bit.
Well, I'd like to understand this one. So you got September of 16, it shows minus 9,000. What is that minus 9,000 against what?
That's we had 9,000 fewer wage and salary jobs that month than we had the year prior.
Than in September of the preceding year, which is also looks like that maybe had been like 1,000 up or something.
Just barely positive, right?
Okay, so that's just a 1 year over year change. Okay, I think I got it. Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. So the 27 months is significant. We looked at other states' recessions from 61 to 2016, last year, I guess. 259 times states have gone through these periods of job losses. 75% of the time, they end within 2 years or less. So this recession of ours, this downturn, has now extended into a little bit of an unusual territory. That's an important point because, and I'll introduce this and come back to it a little bit later, there are different kinds of recessions. One is a business cycle recession. And recession, don't get too hung up on that word. It's a little bit of a big word for a state. Generally, you don't talk recessions for states, all kind of interconnectivity between regions. But so that caveat aside, this economic downturn we're in has now gotten a little long in the tooth. The idea of a business cycle recession, something happens to shock an economy, you absorb the shock, normalcy resumes, growth resumes. That if you've taken economics courses, you'll be roughly familiar with that idea. there's something else that happens, and that's structural change in an economy. So a couple, three examples of states that had longer than two-year recessions. Oregon in the early 80s, right? They lost their timber industry. That's not a business cycle recession. That's a structural change within the economy. That's why that went longer. Florida, interestingly, 2009. Florida, it's off the charts in terms of job loss. They had 690,000 construction jobs going into the Great Recession. At the trough, they had 330,000. They lost 300 and whatever that is, 30,000 construction jobs. The reason that recession extended longer, that economic driver largely disappeared. There was crazy speculative building. We all know the basic story of the Great Recession. But this thing that had contributed to economic growth in Florida pretty much went away. And then the example that you'll all be roughly familiar with is Michigan. Michigan, from 2000 to 2009, lost about 1 million manufacturing jobs. Large-scale manufacturing went away from Michigan's economy. Those are different types of recessions. That's a state going through a structural change. That I hope invites the thought in your minds, what are we in now? I don't know the answer to that. I suspect it's a little bit of a hybrid. But when we studied this a couple of years ago, one of the things we said is that this economic shock that we were all familiar with, oil prices fell, job losses started, and I'll show you a few data points on that in a minute, that shock quite certainly precipitated this second likely shock as we figured out how to fund state government in a new way potentially. That could be shrinking state government. That could be new taxes. That could be less PFD. But it was unusual that this initial shock guaranteed another something in our future. And that's part of what is extending this recession. So just to highlight a little bit where we are now, this data recently came out. This is third quarter wage and salary or wages. Alaska employers paid out $4.55 billion in wages in the third quarter of 2017. That's about $210 million less than 2 years earlier, about $170 million less than last year. So that says, again, to that point, there's not much doubt that we're still, through third quarter at least, still heading south at a reduced rate. But that's we won't spend a lot of time there.
Mr. Chairman, yes, question from Representative Knopp.
Okay, I'm a little confused on this one, like Representative Birch was on the last one. So when you go, so you're saying it? I was good till you said we're still going south.
Yeah.
So. Recent release data wage losses. So the third quarter of 15, we had a $4.76 billion in wage loss. In the third quarter of 17, we had 4.55. So to me, that's going north by $210 million because we actually had less lost wages 2 years farther down.
So the total wages, Rep. Knopp, through the chair, in quarter three, $4.55 billion. So that's $210 million
total,
less.
Okay, total wages,
in 2015.
Not wage loss. Then it's
yeah, you're a step ahead of me. That's okay. Why.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Go ahead.
And hundreds of millions of dollars are starting to kind of mean something to us, right, because we're talking about we need this many more. But this is partly to give you some scale for that.
Question from Representative Birch and then Representative Bull. Representative Birch.
So just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So $4.5 billion times four is 18, plus or minus $18 billion in a year. Is that would be like a gross?
Close. I appreciate the question. Roughly, we have an $18 billion economy. Third quarter is the biggest quarter of the year.
Okay.
So you think of July, August, September. That's when everything is ramped up. Second quarter would be the next biggest. But third quarter, so you wouldn't quite multiply those by four, okay. But roughly.
So I was just trying to do a back of the napkin. So I think last year we had a proposal, an income tax proposal that would have raised, I'm thinking it was like $600 or $700 million. So that would have been applied, 2017 would have been applied against that $18 billion, I would assume. So I was just trying to figure out, you know, percentages, you know, 700 million to eight, you know, just probably 5% or something like that?
Yeah, no, I can't speak to the tax specifically, but those numbers are kind of what I hope to suggest. Right. And some of the context I wanted to provide. $18 billion, that's how much Alaska employers pay out.
That's every pay. Does that include out-of-state paychecks?
It does. It does. So this is data that comes to us, and it's good data because of where it comes from, mandatory quarterly unemployment insurance reporting. So almost all employers are covered by this, by the unemployment insurance system. So it gets good fraud oversight, and so it's solid data.
And Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, the previous graph you showed that was month-to-month comparison, or over-the-year change by month, I guess, and these are not cumulative. But if it were cumulative, obviously the graph would just keep getting larger as far as total job loss. If for that graph to go into the blue, like it was pre, on the left side of your graph, for that to go back into the blue, which it kind of looks like it's heading towards, except for the last couple months, but that would be a good thing. But at the same time, could you also say, well, we've lost so many jobs, we're down near the bottom, and any gain is blue. However, it's not like a hallelujah kind of moment, right?
Through the chair, yes. There's difference. There's a difference between resumed growth and recovery, right? But psychologically, and psychology drives markets to a degree. Resuming growth will matter. That turning point will matter to us. It will be. And in that article that I mentioned that we did, we looked at how long it took states to recover the jobs they'd lost during recessions. And you know, some state, Michigan, again, still hasn't. I don't think. Some states it takes years. The shape of the recovery is interesting, and we'll show a graph here in a minute to show we kind of roared out of our 80s recession. We recovered the jobs we lost there fast. That seems unlikely for this one, partly because of that structural thing that we're sorting out. That answer that question? Okay. So let's zoom out a little bit. So this is the longer term look at Alaska's jobs history, and a couple of things to point out here. One, we earned our reputation as a boom and bust state in the 70s and 80s. No state was growing anywhere near pipeline construction. You know, 25%. That's unheard of. But even early 80s, that's really strong growth. Then we almost imagine a ball bouncing, and the bounces get shorter and shorter and shorter. We had a long period of really remarkable stability. There were two national recessions in that period that we just plowed right through. We just grew right through them. Early 90s, the dot-com, 2001. And I shouldn't say that. I say with this macro indicator, as many of you know, there were questions in 2001 about, we're running out of money, we've got to do something. So there are always a lot of things happening in an economy. But by this measure, steady growth.
Okay, question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I know this includes all the military positions, or does it?
It does not.
Okay.
Military, we calculate separately.
As far as jobs and employment and
not
dollars?
Not population. We track separately. The military they're a little close-fisted with data. So we don't – and this data set, I mentioned the federal-state partnership, it's specifically non-military. But I appreciate you pointing out the military because it's a very big deal in Alaska.
It's huge.
Especially in Fairbanks.
It seems to me like if you were to overlay jobs on top of this, looking at, you know, having lived in Fairbanks for 25 years and seeing the market impact of the military on the community as far as the number of, you know, number of your neighbors, and the same thing in Anchorage and statewide. So there's no Coast Guard people, no...
Not here. Civilian military, and we'll look at a population data set in a minute where military is there. Okay. We do have military data separately. But it's... And fishermen are another one. Fishermen are considered self-employed. So seafood processors are here.
It's not that they're not working. It's just that they're...
That's right. They're not covered by unemployment insurance is part of the challenge. And part of it's that the data set started out non-agricultural. It's definitional stuff that you know nobody cares much about. But it's important to think of who's not there. The self-employed, John Bittner will talk a little bit about that. That's it's important. The military, fishermen.
Well, that's interesting, yeah, because there's thousands of them, I would think.
Yeah, no, and we collect that information and publish it every year. Not just military, but military dependents, right? Fairbanks is a military town to the degree that few places in the country are. Yeah, and you know, Kodiak, Juneau to a degree, Sitka, Anchorage, military matters a lot.
And I guess Representative will ask a question, but I'll just kind of make a comment and see if I'm relatively accurate. But in this, where you're talking about economic growth, a military installation wouldn't necessarily show up as economic growth unless we had something like the F-35s where we're actually bringing people in. It would just be considered stability. It would be more jobs, but it wouldn't be counted as the growing economy unless there was an addition to the installation that we already have. Is that the case?
Correct, Cherokee. You know, the Fairbanks is the one part of the state where we forecast growth for 2018. The reason for that is the F-35s primarily. There's some stuff at CLEAR, too. So as an economic driver, it's part of our forecasts. It's part of our explanation of what moves the numbers, but it's not in the job numbers. Yeah.
Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you asked my question, which was basically this is a chart of growth. So if the base population were to be added, it would show up as growth if you were counting their jobs. However, a lot of military and military dependents do work outside of the base, so that would show up on your through unemployment insurance if a spouse got a job.
Correct, and any non-military civilian employment would, including on the bases. So yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, all right. Thanks. Go ahead. So. One of the things I circled the 80s recession and our current recession, you see here graphically, and we've got numbers to look at it numerically, but this recession is not as deep as the 80s, and if our forecast is correct, it will extend beyond the 80s. And this is our forecast for 2018. We publish this every January. You see our 10 years worth of history. A fair question would be how good are we are forecasting? I mean, we're not oil price bad. This doesn't move as much, and not to, revenue. They know what they're doing. It's just much harder to forecast. This doesn't move in nearly as wide of a band. So historically, we've gotten the direction correct almost all of the time. That's not that big a deal because usually it's up. And usually we're within 0.5%. So, but 2018 is a hard year to forecast. So I wouldn't argue with somebody who said we might grow 0.5%. I wouldn't argue that we might shrink a percent. That's a tough call. So just I want to highlight a little bit the size of this impact we absorbed along the lines of that business cycle recession. So. 2014, we had 15,000 plus oil and gas jobs. Most recently, we have 9,600, more than 5,000 oil and gas jobs, average wage well over $100,000, $600 million gone from our economy, just oil and gas jobs. So that's a big for context, again, back to the $18 billion economy, $600 million from this one industry, a couple of others directly connected to that. Construction down 15% over the last 2 years. State government down 7.4%. These are jobs, not wages. Professional and business services down. So professional and business services, that's engineers, lawyers, accountants, geologists, and those pay fairly well too. So it's been a big hit to our economy. We have mostly absorbed that. We keep thinking we see the oil and gas jobs leveling off. It's and the last few months they're about 9,600, so we think we see it again. At some point, the level will at least stop going down. It may start going up. It doesn't tend to stay very static.
Question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quick question: as we're showing the losses. Do you have another slide where you're showing the increase then for jobs with regard to tourism or health care?
Rep. Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, we have that data, and health care has been about the only growth sector through this period. Local government, interestingly, has been flat to just barely up. Remember that tribal government is included in local government, so that's part of the, whenever we say local government's up, we can expect a call from a few municipalities, which we understand. But other than those two over this recessionary period, and really that one, I mean, healthcare had strong growth last year, 5.1%, for example. We forecast a little bit slower growth 2018, but that's really the only outlier. MATSU, interestingly, geographically, is almost an outlier. It just recently started losing jobs. Don't forget how many MATSU residents work on the slope, and don't forget how many MATSU residents work in Anchorage. So to say that MATSU's doing fine is not quite
I
the case.
I haven't forgotten.
Okay.
Thanks.
So jumping forward, moving to population now, this graph, the red line shows employment percent change, the blue line shows population. And you see the clear correlation between the two. When employment goes way up, population goes up. The 70s, the clearest example, the 80s, we had really strong population growth to match our, roughly match our job growth. And then when it goes down, you see some connection there. When the numbers get much milder, the correlation, it's harder to see the connection. But, and then the other thing I wanted to point out, the very end of this, the far right side, you see a year of population loss for the first time in 29 years. One newspaper said, thousands flee Alaska in response to that. And one of our responses, sure, and we'll talk about this in a minute, thousands flee Alaska every year. Thousands come to Alaska every year. That one of the stories of this recession is how stable our population and our housing market have been. And that surprised some Alaskans who lived through the 80s. But that's part of the story so far. And that's a little bit what this is about. So this is our long march of almost uninterrupted population growth. So we've got even here clear back to World War II. And four of those years we didn't grow. That's not to say we haven't had more years where we've had net migration be negative. But built into this is natural increase, births minus deaths. And we had 2 years of population. We had 1 year of population loss after pipeline completion, 1978. We had 2 years in the 80s, 15,000 people. So a lot of people remember the 80s as, you know, everybody's leaving. History becomes mythology a little bit, right? We went from 550,000 people to 535,000 people. That's a real loss, but it's not last ones off the Titanic, you know, leave the keys behind or anything.
Dan, we've got a question from Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have these numbers without death and birth? I mean, I understand people die, and I guess more people are born than are dying, so that's going to raise your population. So even if there's a net migration out between sort of working age adults, the birth gain sort of stunts that. So do you have a – my question is, do you have a number of people, the population without the births and deaths?
We do. We produce, lots of data on our website, obviously, but we produce annually, it's called a population overview. And we show births, deaths, net natural increase, in migration, out migration. And we'll talk about this in a minute, age migration. Age, a lot. We've got big things going on with our seniors. We don't have a lot of change happening with our kids. And there's some things with age-based migration. In fact, we've got an article coming out in the March issue of our Alaska Economic Trends that's going to look at migration closely. But, yes, we have all of the components of change, we call them. Four years out of these 71. But one of them is 2017. Have we lost population? But not now, and really not for an extended period of time ever has Alaska gone through population loss. Those last 5 or 6 years are worth paying attention to, though. That's basic population stability, and you know, with the what I said about us trying to be very hard to be objective, we also try to be value neutral. Some people would say, "Oh, we've got too many people here anyway," and that's an acceptable argument to make. Some people would say, "Oh, we want a million people here by 2020." either one. That's good, bad. That's not really our call. But history shows growth. That's normal. That's status quo. A few years ago, pre-recession, some people whose names you might recognize said we're going to lose 100,000 people in the next few years. And our reaction, the people who work with this data said, maybe, but I hope they understand how dramatically unprecedented that would be. That does not happen. That has not happened. Doesn't mean it couldn't, but it's very unlikely. So, and to that point, this is it shows, and please ask any questions. So this shows our gross migration flows. That's the tallest gray line, the gray lines, and then net migration. This is over quite an extended period of time, 1990 to 2016. Anytime Alaska shows up at either far end of a data set, we get interested. We want to know how we're different, why we're different. What does that mean? So we have the biggest migration flows as a percentage of our population of any state in the nation, comfortably. 12.3%, I think it is, of our population. So we've got these big migration flows. What does that mean? A couple of thoughts. One, we have this big pull to Alaska. Why do people move to Alaska? Economic opportunity is obviously one reason. We write a big check in terms of the quality of life here, and I think we cash that check, right? It's spectacular for a certain kind of person who wants to come here. Outdoor, there's a reason that we have the highest veteran population in the nation. I think it's quality of life. We offer something to that group. But we also throw people out at a higher rate than any other state. We don't throw them out, obviously. They decide that the winter's too long. They want to retire somewhere warmer. But part of the reason I think this is important to be aware of and to think about is that quality of life matters. Stability matters. Migration flows are big for Alaska, and if they change a little bit, that affects a lot of things. So looking at a few of the other states, what you see broadly is lots of movement over this period to warm weather states. Nevada, Arizona's there. And you see Wyoming, Hawaii are interesting. Both of those have some similarities to Alaska for different reasons. But do understand there's an unusual amount of coming and going to Alaska among states.
So they got a question, and then Representative Birch. So does this number include military migration?
It does. Yes.
So that as a percentage of our population, that could be significant.
Correct.
Okay. So and Representative Birch.
Thank you again, Don. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the just to clarify, so I'm looking at 12%. Is that 12%? Between 1990 and 2016, it looks like our population grew from around 550,000 to 750,000. And so I'm just trying to understand what numbers you use to build the graph.
Yeah, so gross, that's an average percentage of our population that is coming or going every year. So don't – and let me – I can see that I've got more work to do to clarify that. So the net migration number, the fact that it's a little bit negative, shows that for all of those years, all of that coming and going, bigger than any other state, it's netted to a little bit less than zero. So that says, and don't think of these things too distinctly, but our population growth has come. If we had exactly matching births and deaths, this would say our population would have shrunk a little bit over that period. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the components of change of population, this big coming and going.
I get the coming, the going part. We gained 500 or 200,000 people between 90 and 2016. So that's all right. I can understand it later. I'm still a little fuzzy on exactly how you built the 12%.
Well, that's understandable. The point of this is mostly just to show we have an unusual amount of coming and going. Mm-hmm. And it's not so. Nevada, for example, look at Nevada. Mm-hmm. They have strong net positive migration. So they also have a lot of coming and going. It's contributed to 2% growth per year in Nevada. Mm-hmm. So they're growing from, and this is state to state and international. Most of the migration that happens is state to state, 97% of it. But
okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
And Representative Bull has a question.
You answered it with your analysis
okay.
a second ago.
Okay. Go ahead. So finally, just takeaways here. We're not out of the woods, and we're not spiraling downwards, either one of those things. We continue to lose jobs at a fairly moderate rate. Our population has been remarkably stable through this period. Understand that net migration has been negative for 5 years in a row now. And that's a big factor in Alaska. We forget about it sometimes. And that our forecast is for 2018 is for another year of job losses. A lot of uncertainty in that. And I want to end on that note. Uncertainty, and Musin has done an interesting recent project, the cost of uncertainty. Economies rely on stability and certainty and kind of an expectation of a certain, normalcy. And that's one of the things we're struggling with. Whether we go positive or not, that will be some breaks. That will be economic breaks on our growth until that all gets sorted. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're not spiraling downwards, is what you said. But I think that very first graph showing job loss comparison by month, year to year, until we're in the blue, which means we're having a net job loss, and if that was a we're going the trend, even though the graph might go up, the trend is a negative. As long as we're losing jobs, we're descending.
Correct, Rep. Well, through the chair, if we're below zero, we continue to lose jobs. The fact that the you could draw a slope line that would be positive until we're above zero, we continue to get smaller as a job market.
And yeah. Follow up. And the last page of your net migration negative for 5 years, so population isn't negative. Again, birth, death, more people are having babies than are dying. But net migration is negative, and I don't know what those numbers are, and you didn't show them. But job loss coupled with more people leaving than coming in, other than babies, is another sort of auger down. In a sense, I would. It's negative. I guess both those things are negative numbers. That, and not to say positive migration means the economy's doing well, but job gain would tend to be coupled with net positive migration.
Correct. With the additional twist that how Alaska's doing relative to the U.S. So if we look, for example, here, you see the population takes a little bump up. In 2009, 2010, we actually lost some jobs in 2009, but the U.S. economy was going through Armageddon, right? So fewer Alaskans were likely to leave, slightly more people were likely to come to Alaska. The relative strength of our economy compared to our feeder states, Washington, Oregon, not so much Oregon, California, Texas, those states. Yeah. And you're correct that when we are growing, when our economy is growing strongly, then population and specifically net migration tends to be positive.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Dan.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Next up, we have Musin Ghatabi. Mr. Ghatabi, if you are online, please place your name and affiliation on the letter or on the record and provide us with your presentation, please.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. My name is Musin Ghatabi. I am an assistant professor of economics at ICER, the Institute of Social and Economic Research at UAA. What I was asked to do is provide a comparison slash contrast to the work that Dan has just spoken about. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to be referring to a couple of reports that we've put out in the last 2 months. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at them or not. One is titled What Do We Know About the Alaska Recession and the Fiscal Crunch? And the other one is How Does Alaska Spending Compare? The first one is an ambitious, broad overview of economic conditions, tries to tackle that question of uncertainty that Dan has alluded to, and then does a comparison of Alaska's broad-based taxes to the rest of the country, and then finally provides an exercise that shows the trade-offs between higher withdrawal rates from the permanent fund and its effects on potential bad outcomes, such as the earnings reserve going to zero, and then the implications on future growth. So I'll start where Dan left off and say, first of all, we don't say this enough, but we appreciate the work that the Department of Labor does, and we wouldn't be able to do any analysis if it weren't for the data they produce and the help they provide us on a regular basis. And so I think that we're indebted to them. I broadly speaking, I agree directionally with everything that Dan has said. I think that the decline in the rate of job losses is good, but it doesn't mean a recovery. I think we're far from a recovery. I say that because, I mean, fundamentally, the thing that I've been repeating over the last couple of months is the oil and gas affects Alaska through two channels. One is obviously from 2005 to 2014, 90% of unrestricted GF was coming from oil revenues, and through non-permanent fund savings, and then in the future through the permanent fund, we're going to plug that hole. The difficulty is that oil and gas also affected the Alaska economy through the private sector, not directly through employment or directly through oil and gas employment, but more importantly through, you know, spin-off jobs, support sector jobs, household-dependent sector-type jobs. And that economic engine has been weakened. Dan mentioned this, but I do this exercise in the report where I compare June 2017 employment to June 2014 employment for oil and gas, and show that as of June 2017, oil and gas employment was 75% of what it was in June 2014. Now, that means that this economic engine that we've relied on for years is much smaller, much weaker. That's also true for professional and business services, which are about 90% of where they were in terms of jobs in 2014. State government is at about 95%, right? And so we have these sectors that are part of what I refer to as the first wave that got hit whenever oil prices declined, that are still considerably below where they were a few years ago. Regarding the how this played out, what's interesting is my forecast for 2017 was much more aggressive than how things played out, right? And so 2016, our forecast was very close to what we ended up experiencing. In 2017, on the other hand, I was expecting considerably more losses than what we're going to end up actually losing. And one of the reasons is that local government has held up remarkably well. I still think there is quite a bit of downside going forward because, again, when you do that comparison relative to 2014, you find that it's basically flat, which is surprising given that about a third of all local government revenues come from the state, and we know that state government revenues have been declining. So, yes, I think that it's good that the losses are slowing. I think that the fact that we've lost fewer jobs this year than I anticipated is due to the fact that local governments held well, support sectors have held up considerably better than I anticipated. The danger going forward is, if they're mature enough, if some of these sectors are mature enough, strong enough to withstand an extended period of slowdown. And obviously, that's what we don't know, right? And so how much can some of these businesses sustain if economic activity is slower for, you know, the next two and a half years? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, Mr. Giftavi. Thank you.
Yeah. So I think that that's the when I look at the picture, I mean, the difficulty in assessing 2018, as Dan was alluding to, is that if we go by the forecast that I produced last year, like DOL, I expect the rate of losses to continue slowing, and I think that next year we'll lose about a little bit less than 1% of jobs. But the underlying question and the reason why 2018 is really difficult to forecast is if there are adjustments that were made in the short run by some of these sectors, some of these businesses, to potentially mitigate the shock, then will that show up in 2018? Meaning, can we have, I don't want to use the word double dip, but because the downside is not negligible, then we're in a territory where we could potentially see 2018 and 2019 having job losses that mirror what we've experienced in 17. And so I think that that's the hardest part of this conversation, because like I said, a third of local government revenues come from the state. Yes, we've had a really good summer, but where is the engine of recovery? And you know, when we look at our economy, yes, of course, healthcare has done well, but healthcare is not a basic sector that generates money from the outside and therefore cannot be our way out of this recession and cannot be the future economic engine. So that's my broad assessment of economic activity. I'm happy to answer any questions or any comments that you may have, and I can move on to the uncertainty if you wish.
Okay, and then Dr. Giftavi, I do have one question, and I guess in your research, the work that you have done looking at other states, have you seen recoveries that have been generated by specific sectors that have been either new or grown in those states, or have you had that opportunity to look at that? So I guess I'm curious about what kinds of sector changes or economic drivers that other states have seen that have pulled them out of their recessions.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that Dan spoke to that a little bit. What I will say is, and I've said this for years, I don't believe, I mean, Alaska, I'll answer it about Alaska and then I'll talk a little bit about the comparison. I don't believe that Alaska has a diversification problem, because our structure, meaning sectoral structure, does not differ drastically from that of other states. Alaska has a leakage problem, meaning that a tremendous amount of value is generated within states, but a lot of value leaves the state. And I genuinely believe that if we are in this new world order where oil and gas plays a much smaller role, I don't think our way out of a recovery is going to be creating brand new sectors. I think it's going to be potentially efforts to think very critically about the supply chain and ensure that a lot of money that's generated within states stays here. Regarding other states, I think that Dan mentioned a couple of really important examples, and I think that our experience right now, in my mind, resembles, you know, Michigan and resembles states that have lost economic bases. And I'm not suggesting that we're losing oil and gas, but I think that it's, you know, when you think about capital spending alone, it's down, private capital spending in the state is down about $2.5 billion by proxies that I've used. So unless we imagine something drastic happening to where we get that back, it's very hard for me to think about this as being the average business cycle recession. And in those, most states just recover because business cycles go up and down. And I think it's much more important for us to think about this one as a recession where a state loses an economic engine, and what are the ways in which we can plug some of that hole. I've raised a question recently, and I don't know that there is a lot of appetite for it, but in my mind, aside from the supply chain crashing, the other significant amount of money that we have is in the permanent fund, and the permanent fund as of last month was bigger than Alaska's GDP. Alaska's GDP is 50-some billion dollars. The permanent fund is 64 or 63 billion dollars. And one of the questions that I've raised is, should the permanent fund play some role in private economic activity if we've lost our economic engine? And so this is a long answer to your question, but I think that the supply chain is really the lower hanging fruit as opposed to new industries. And I think the question about, you know, the financial resource playing some role in the private economy is one that merits investigation.
Thank you, Dr. Khattabi. We do have a question from Representative Josephson as well.
Dr. Khattabi, Andy Josephson here, and I read with real interest your piece in the Anchorage Daily News, if that's what it's called. I know the name changes frequently, but you noted that you used the term policy uncertainty, and you said that there's a lost opportunity that goes with not making economic decisions. And you believed that was somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 to $600 million per year in private investment. And I guess my question is, how can history gauge if at the pivotal moment, and I suppose every moment is pivotal, but the slump began in August, late August, I think, 2014. I know the governor in June of 2015 called for a fiscal summit at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, so he responded within 5 or 6 months of his inauguration to the crisis. But essentially what we've been very good at in Juneau is cutting, in my mind. We've been very poor at everything else. And how can I know if we had chosen not to cut the operating budget 24%, but instead cut it 10%, and we had pushed for a balanced fiscal plan and sort of primed the pump? Maybe we had even done what the governor suggested in 2016 and paid. He had proposed in one piece of legislation paying all the tax credits off in a single year. He had a fiscal note for $1 billion to do it. In other words, if we had marched forward with confidence instead of passivity, and I'm obviously making a statement here, how could we know what the difference would have amounted to?
Yeah, I mean, that counterfactual we don't observe, right? And so, unfortunately, the reality is that we see the current status of things, which is what Dan and I have been talking about. The exercise that I did was an attempt to get closer to answer your question, right? And so, because a question that I receive often is essentially the one that you're posing, which is, the presumption was that doing nothing is costless. The exercise that I undertake is one that draws from the national literature and basically says, well, we find that even in times where there is policy uncertainty about just who the next governor is going to be, we're not talking as much uncertainty as Alaska is experiencing, the national literature finds that around those elections, private investment declines by 5 to 15%. And so what I do is I take that 5 to 15%, I use a proxy of capital spending through the construction forecast that we produce here at ICER, and I come up with that number of $200 to $600 million. Now, if you take that $200 and $600 million in private capital, so assume that we have had for 5 years average of an additional $300 or $400 million of capital spending, That would have translated, obviously, into additional jobs. That would have translated into more economic activity. And the numbers that Dan was showing you would arguably have been lower, right? And so, meaning the losses would have been lower. It's very hard to go back and say those losses or those investments would have resulted us would have resulted in us being in a completely different path, or that the economy would be growing significantly. That I don't know, but I think what they do tell us quite unambiguously is that they're of the same type of magnitude as the, meaning the losses from foregone investment are of the same magnitude as the potential losses, the short-term losses that people were worried about stemming from taxes or from government cuts or from something else. And so essentially this says that waiting is actually not costless. And not deciding on a path does result in people sitting in the sidelines, does result in missed opportunities, and does potentially result in this lingering recession, slowdown, whatever we want to call it. So, I mean, that's how I would answer it. Unfortunately, we don't have an exact number of what that counterfactual of what Alaska would have looked like if we had set a path, you know, 4 years ago or 3 years ago.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Katabi. Do we have any other questions, Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Dr. Katabi, I missed the early part of your presentation, so I'm sorry if this question was already covered. But Mr. Robinson, in his presentation, talked about structural changes and that, you know, certain states had a structural, you know, they lost a whole industry or something like that. And I'm guessing that Alaska hasn't really had a structural change, but as you said, a supply chain situation. I'm guessing that the decrease of volume and the price of oil was the start of this downturn. And you hear a lot of people talking about the next Prudhoe Bay or ANWR or NPRA or the next big oil discovery as our savior that will fill the pipeline, and if the prices stay about where they are, go up a little bit, that will be all that we need, or something to that effect. Is that what you mean by supply chain? And am I correct that we haven't really had a structural change, but more just a change in flow? And what do you think of the assessment that an increase in flow, and I'm talking oil or anything, but mainly oil, an increase in flow will sort of right the ship?
What I mean by the supply chain is think about menu of spending for businesses, or think about what businesses buy in order to produce whatever it is that they're producing. The supply chain, in my mind, is the fact that a lot of businesses are tied to the rest of the country and leak a considerable amount of money. In other words, that in order to produce a dollar of whatever it is that we produce in Alaska, we spend 50, 60, 70 cents outside of the state. And I think that going forward, figuring out a way, for example, to retain more money from the fishing industry, or more money from other industries that already exist is a much better strategy than trying to create a brand new industry that will potentially replace oil and gas. And so that's what I mean by the supply chain. I refer to the leakage or the amount of money that leaves the state of Alaska after having been produced here. And I think that that's a strategy that's feasible that starts at the local level, right? And so we have a lot of communities that are resource rich, but when you look at the imprint or the footprint of the resource on some of those places, it's fairly minimal because the resource gets extracted and then leaves the borough or leaves the state and makes very little difference in some of those places. And so when I say supply chain, I mean, can we figure out ways of tying these already existing industries better to the Alaska economy so that we can keep some of that wealth. Now, regarding your second point of can some of these discoveries right the ship, it's difficult to, I mean, unless we're talking about a significant one, is that even if there are discoveries, that's not going to happen overnight, right? And so that's more of a long-term fix, I suppose, or at least medium-term fix. And then the second thing is, do we envision oil and gas playing as big of a role as it did 5, 6, 10 years ago in the Alaska economy? And that's the question that I think really matters and we need to think about carefully, is that even if there is a discovery, or if oil prices do go back up, do we envision levels of capital spending, do we envision levels of employment that mirror those that we've experienced in the past? And if no, then we need to think about the structural side of things, of what's next for Alaska, right? What's the next chapter for Alaska, and what is the mixture of industries slash some of these better attempts to retain the wealth generated here that take us to, you know, 2030 and 2040 as a prosperous state? And so that's how I see it.
Thank you, Dr. Katavi, and enjoyed this discussion. It's been very interesting for me. We're going to move on to our last presenter at this point. Do appreciate your availability, and do look forward to having some future conversations with you. I am very interested, and will spend a little more time with your reports at this point. And thank you for
having me.
All right, Mr. Bittner, if you will come forward. And we do have one more presentation, and thank you for your patience. Go ahead, place your name, affiliation on the record, and provide us with your presentation.
Thank you for having me. Through the chair, my name is John Bittner. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Small Business Development Center, and I have the dubious distinction of being the least intelligent person you're going to hear from today on this panel. I had no idea I was up against two preeminent economists. I apologize in advance. So I'm going to give you an idea of who we are, what we do, and then we'll go into some of the data that we've seen in 2017 and some trends we're seeing in 2018. The Alaska Small Business, or Small Business in Alaska, and this is, I preface most of my presentations on this by making sure we're talking about the same thing. 99, actually over 99% of all businesses in the state qualify as small businesses under the federal guidelines that we use. So that's under 500 employees, under $20 million in annual revenue. So when I say small businesses, I'm really talking about basically any business you can think of that isn't the oil and gas, mining, or major medical industries. To give you a sense of the scope, they employ about 142,761 Alaskans in 2017. That's actually up from 2016. And they represent over 72,000 actual distinct businesses. And that's actually up from 2016 as well. If you look at some of the other distinctions that small businesses have, when you talk about generating income from outside of the state, they represent 75% of all the exporters in the state. So when you're thinking about accessing markets outside of the United States, it's our small businesses that are leading the way. If you look at the breakdown by industry, it's pretty much what you would expect. Healthcare is up there, food and accommodation, retail, construction, and professional services. We are seeing an upswing in, and this is by percentage, not by gross number, manufacturing, professional technical services, and some increase in food manufacturing in particular. The SBDC is formed through the Small Business Administration federally. We are a federal program housed within the University of Alaska Anchorage within their Business Enterprise Institute. We have seven centers: Anchorage, Mat-Su, Fairbanks, Kenai, Homer, Juneau, and Ketchikan, and 17 employees plus four student researchers. The majority of those employees are business advisors, and they help about 1,000 small businesses every year. They provide workshop trainings to another 3,000. And we run the Alaska Lemonade Day program, which provides early entrepreneurship training to over 2,500 kids across the state, all the way from Ketchikan to Uktiavik. In 2017, we actually had a bit of a record-breaking year for our organization. Over $18 million was raised in capital infusion from our clients, 6,200 hours of advising, again, 1,000 clients served. And these clients created 460 new jobs and 155 new businesses. And we were active in over 50 communities. So the reason I'm telling you this isn't to pitch my organization. I'm trying to give you a sense for when we talk about trends we're seeing in the business, the small business community, we're not just talking about the major urban centers. We're actively participating in business development across the state, pretty much in any major community. To give you a sense, again, we mentioned the fact that 75% of them, of all foreign exporters are small businesses. There's also a large contingent of them that are owned by minority owners. So in particular, when we look at the immigrant population, they tend to be more entrepreneurial than native-born by the numbers. And so we think that there's a direct correlation between that and the foreign export numbers that you see there. They're accessing the markets that they're familiar with. In 2018, we're actually seeing even stronger numbers, and this is all sort of leading into trends that we're seeing from an economic perspective and that are being reinforced by a small business survey that we did that I'll talk about in just a minute. Just year to date, we've got a total of 333 new clients. To give you a feeling, this is somewhere around 40 to 50% higher than the same time last year. In January alone, we had 130 new clients. In the previous year, we had about 60. So we're seeing a huge amount of activity in people looking to start new businesses, looking to get into industries, and it's not the industries that we're normally seeing. We're spread out a lot more. We're seeing a lot more diversification than we normally do. And these aren't all new businesses. If you look at the numbers, it's only about 50 of them are brand new businesses. We're actually seeing people looking to expand their existing businesses or transition and purchase businesses where the owners are aging out and looking to, and they don't have a natural heir apparent. If you look at the gross amount of capital infusion, it's hard to calculate non-bank financing, but in terms of bank loans, there was about $250 million worth of loans provided to small businesses in 2017 alone, and that was through, I believe, 17,000 individual loans. And these are loans specifically to small businesses, usually under $100,000. So that's $250 million of capital infusion in the middle of what most people are calling a fairly significant recession. And it, like I said, it spread largely. Our clients are pre-venture, but we work with companies all the way from existing to exiting. So we wanted to get a feel for, because what we were seeing didn't jive necessarily with what we were hearing through the media and through public perception, we decided to do something that we had never done before. We went back through the last 4 years of clients, and we tried to survey all 2,500 of them. Nobody likes filling out surveys, so we got about 350, which we're assured is a statistically significant sample. And this was designed to do a couple of things. One, it was to really lock in on how their last year had been in terms of finances, hiring and firing, growth potential, things like that, but also to project outward into next year and see what 2018, what they thought was going to happen. And a couple of interesting things came out of this. It was a 40-question survey, by the way, which was, I don't know if you've tried to convince anyone to fill out a 40-question survey. It was a lot of phone calls and begging on our part.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh.
Yes,
Mr.
Representative.
Yeah. Don, so you just said that you sent out a survey to 2,500 clients over the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So how many of them 2,500 are still in business?
The majority. We did have a handful that had gone out of business. It was... don't quote me on this, but it was under 30. It was under 30, and it wasn't that many. And what was interesting in about that was the majority of them, I think about two-thirds indicated that it was for financial reasons, that they failed. The rest of them, though, it was a series of personal life events. They moved out of state, they got divorced, things along those lines. We actually were expecting a lot larger. Now, there could be just... You know, full disclosure through the chair. Sorry, full disclosure. That could be because people that have exited their businesses may not have been as incentivized to respond to the survey. Some of the highlights from this survey: we asked them what their biggest barriers to business were. Obviously, funding. If you do any work with small businesses, finding capital is always an issue. But the other two are kind of interesting. One is the high cost of operating in Alaska, and this broke down into two sort of main thrusts. One is the cost of shipping, both into and out of the state. It limited the amount of activity they could do, amount of clients they could reach. The second one was healthcare, and this was pretty significant. And it tied into a larger issue that we'll talk about in a second, which is the challenges to hiring new employees. The last one was a toss-up between the economy and sort of the political uncertainty. And this was part of a larger symptom that we saw that also didn't necessarily correlate with their perception of their own future success. And this is an interesting sort of disconnect that we notice. We don't have a really good explanation for it, but on the next slide I'll talk a little bit about what we're interpreting this as. In terms of hiring new employees, and the majority of people we talked to were planning to either hire or maintain their employee levels. Number one with a bullet, almost by, I think, an order of magnitude, was a lack of qualified applicants. And this broke down into two separate sectors. There was about two-thirds of them were technical skill sets, but about a third of the respondents said it was soft skills. They couldn't find people that would show up on time. They couldn't find people that knew how to interface with a customer. They couldn't find people that understood how it worked to work, quite frankly. And that was a real problem. The good news is we feel this is a solvable problem. I mean, much more than trying to get more PhDs here or to generate that level of technical skill sets in response to what we're seeing in the communities, the university is working on that, and we feel that they're doing a fairly good job responding. But the soft skills, that starts much earlier. I mean, that's a different equation altogether. And we're hoping to work with, this is another reason we got into the Lemonade Day program, to work with kids earlier to try and teach them this is what goes into running a business. This is what goes into being responsible and fiscally aware. And the responses there have been good, but I think more could be done there, especially based on the feedback we're getting from employers. This is where it gets interesting. So we asked them three different questions.
We'll get a question from Representative.
Oh,
yeah. Thank you. The last culture fit at the bottom of your page. Mm-hmm. Do you? I guess there's probably a couple possibilities for that. And I, as a small business owner and employer myself, I've encountered this, and maybe you're about to speak to it. But the culture, not necessarily the culture fit between the business owner and the employee, but the culture fit between the generation of people. Now, perhaps, that comes out looking for work and, like you said, doesn't show up or just doesn't really want to work that hard or needs constant validation or stroking that maybe wasn't around 10 or 20 years ago. And I don't know if you're finding that in your responses.
Partly, yeah. I mean, what we're seeing is a blend of things. One is there is a generational disconnect, and it's partly due to a shift in what the younger generations focus on, how they process things and what's important to them. They grew up in, you know, the Great Recession, the National Recession, and so their perception of what a career path looks like is different than I think even my own is. I mean, you know, most of us look at a career as a long-term stable situation within a single company, or at least, you know, not terribly many companies. The average time of employment for, I believe, the millennial generation is somewhere on the nature of 3 to 4 years. So they're shifting jobs pretty quickly, and that's an interesting disconnect. But there's also a problem with finding people that can fit the culture just in general, and that seemed to be not as associated with generational differences as it was with, I feel that small business owners tend to do things in a certain way, and you don't have a lot of apparatus to support sort of systems as much as you would find into a larger organization. So it was 50-50, but yeah, that generational thing is a real issue.
Question from Representative Birch.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. You know, there's nobody in this room that doesn't remember their first job. You know, whether it was you know, selling, you know, berries at the side of the road as a you know, high schooler or whatever. Everybody remembers their first job. And have you seen any erosion in, you know, because of, you know, in the ability of, you know, young adults and you know, I mean, high school kids, summer job, summer employment. Have you seen any erosion in that? And what comes to mind, I spent a number of years on the board at Hilltop Ski Area, and we had a lot of kids start there, and that was their first job. Had to show up on time, had to be respectful of their students. The little kids are teaching how to ski, and they had you know, a list of obligations. And I don't know what's going on in the, you know, from a business standpoint, to see if you know, what's your sense on how that's progressing, or is there anything that we can do to improve that?
Through the chair, I think that the upcoming generation is going to be one of the more entrepreneurial generations we're going to see. And we're seeing this through Lemonade Day. 2,500 kids, and this is without a terrible amount of
resources on our part. I mean, we had one staff person managing this program. It's not terribly overfunded. But we managed to get thousands of children across the state. And some of the highest performers were in some of the most remote communities. I believe Nome pretty consistently has the highest grossing lemonade stand in the state. I don't know how, but I mean, it is, the numbers they post are really impressive. But we're seeing that once you show them what's possible, once you get them over that initial hurdle and teach them that this is not just something fun you can do for pocket money, it's a viable career path, they really embrace that. And I think that we're seeing that a lot more, not only with the K through 12 age, but if you look at the types of small business owners we're seeing at the SBDC, they actually tend to skew on either side of the age demographic spectrum. We're seeing a lot of the millennials and even some of the younger generation that are really interested in creating their own jobs, frankly. And then we're seeing a lot of the baby boomers and the older generation looking to either supplement retirement income or pursue a passion project that they'd still like to get paid for. So it's actually kind of an interesting split. But I think there's a lot of potential there, and anything we can do, like the programs that King Career Center and others are doing to really support youth entrepreneurship, are going to pay unimaginable dividends going forward. And the kids really seem to like it.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. We're in the home stretch, I promise. So here's where the disconnect gets interesting, and I talked to you a little bit about this. When we asked them what they thought about the future of the state's economy, they were wildly pessimistic. Almost 80% of the respondents said that they were unsure or pessimistic about where the state was heading. When they asked about the local economy, it wasn't much better. 66% felt the same about the local economy. When we asked about them, though, 64% thought that their financial situation would be good or very good in the next 12 months, and only 1 in 10 thought it would be worse. So to put this into another way, I'm doing great, everything else is on fire, which really doesn't actually make any sense if you think it through, you know, holistically. And what we're sort of interpreting this as, and like I said, this is the first year we've done this survey, so we don't have a lot of trend data to give you, but what we're interpreting this as is what they know the most about, they're the most optimistic about. So they know their businesses inside and out. They know how they did last year, and 66% of them said they did as good, if not better, than they did the year before last year. And they're projecting they're going to do even better next year. But they don't necessarily understand as much what's going on the macro level. Because why would they, right? I mean, this is complicated stuff. It's billions of dollars being talked about. That's a lot to wrap your head around. But if you look at the numbers that Department of Labor and the things that Dr. Mussin are saying, I mean, it's not great, but we're not in the 80s again. This isn't, you know, last person out, close the door and turn off the lights on the state. And when it comes on the micro level like this, we actually have a lot to be positive about. The majority of them are looking to hire. The majority of them are looking to raise capital, and they're raising different forms of capital than they have in the past. It used to be almost entirely either grants or loans. And more recently, we're seeing a diversification into crowdfunding, into angel investments, into even venture capital in some senses, both locally and outside. As the national economy rises, we're seeing more capital unlocked from the lower 48 that's interested in not necessarily coming to Alaska for the 10x return, but to be able to invest in a nascent economic or entrepreneurial community that can really use the help. And so, I mean, from our perspective, there's a lot to be positive about. And this is more along those lines. 20% did report lower revenues in 2017, but small businesses are naturally chaotic when it comes to stuff like this. If you look at the actual statistics for this type of business, that's actually not terrible. So to tie it all together, what does it mean? The Alaska economy is changing, and I think you've heard that theme probably put a lot more succinctly by the others, in that our economy is diversifying, our focus is changing, the types of businesses we're seeing are different, and the industries we should be focusing on are different. They're ones that I fully agree with Dr. Mussin's statement that we should be focusing on industries that are already strong here. It makes way more sense to try and support the tourism industry, the natural resources industry. I believe the healthcare industry actually has some potential, and others, to really try and grow a new economic sector. It won't replace oil. It won't. But it can diversify our economy and make this transition a little more seamless. And the small businesses that we work with, I believe, are leading the way on that front. There's a lot to be optimistic about for small businesses in 2018. And we did ask them what the barriers were, and those barriers are not small. But we feel that some of them are fixable under the right circumstances, provided we can find a way to come together and support these businesses as they grow. With that, I will let you get to the Filipino celebration tonight.
Do you have a question from Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the respondents to the survey were people that you've helped start a business in the last 4 years. Is that correct?
Start or that we've worked with. Some of them were already in business when they came to us, but they're all SBDC clients.
Okay, thank you. I guess I was just wondering if they're all brand new, then any growth, you know, when you first start out, there'd be a lot of growth. But if they've been in business for 10 years, then they might have a different outlook on the local or state economy.
And it's a mix. It'll be about somewhere around 40% will be either just launched or within the first few years, and the rest will be in varying stages of aging out, all the way through exit.
Thank you.
Any other questions? No, thank you, Mr. Bittner.
Thank you.
And we do have one last item to come before us. We do have House Bill 306 coming back before us. If we can have Deputy Commissioner Rob come forward, please. And can you briefly reintroduce the bill for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. Just as a reminder, House Bill 306 moves to take the disbursement options for retirees from statute and move them to regulations. That will allow the department to be more nimble as new options for disbursements come out. Moving these things to regulations enables them to still be fully exposed to the public process as we add new options or remove old options. Things move through the ARM board, which is a public process, as well as anything in regulation has a public comment period as well.
Okay, thank you. And we have any questions for the Deputy Commissioner, Representative Birch?
What's the net effect of this effort? I mean, if this happened, in reading through it, it sounds like it would permit a maybe an annuity program or you know, some different options. But how do you see it? I mean, what kind of flexibility will that enable through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, it will allow the department to respond more quickly to our retirees and to offer a better range of products or to be able to make changes more quickly and easily if things are in regulation versus statute. Did that answer your question?
Well, do you have a concrete example? What's an example of something I've read through what's being deleted here, but I'm trying to get a kind of a handle on exactly what that how that would impact a beneficiary here.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Kathy Lee is here from the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and she's got all sorts of examples.
Okay. Ms. Lee, going to come forward? Oh, okay.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Deputy Director and Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Through the Chair, Representative Birch, one of the options that the ARM Board is currently looking at is a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal option. And this is an option where a participant can go into the plan about 10 years before they retire, any time within 10 years, but not before 10 years. And they can pay an insurance premium to insure their balance. So at any time after they enter the program, the highest balance that they receive in their account will be what their monthly benefit payment will be based on. This allows them to enjoy the upside of the market, but protects them from the downside. And this is a very important consideration when you're looking at preparing participants for retirement readiness, because if the market falls out right at the time you're trying to retire, that can drastically change your balance, your monthly benefit, and your plans just went out the window. This is not an option that is currently included in the language of the disbursement options in statute. So if we were to add this one, or want to add this one, we would not be able to add it to the PERS and TERS defined contribution plans. We also would not be able to add another option, which is a qualified lifetime annuity contract. This is a deferred annuity, and it has a specific definition with the Internal Revenue Service, and it defers the annuity until age 80 and removes it from the requirement for the minimum distribution requirement at 70 and a half.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So who else, any other private or governmental agencies offering the first plan you spoke about, who else is doing that currently? When you said employees have an option of insuring, paying in and insuring their benefits at retirement, who else currently in the private or public sector is offering that today?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, I'm sorry I can't list the states right off. I can get you that information, but there are other states that are offering this to their defined contribution members, as well as corporations in the private sector.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions for the Deputy Commissioner or Director? Seeing none, public testimony is still open. I don't have anybody else signed up for public testimony, so I will close public testimony at 4:46 p.m. And that brings the bill back before the committee. Is there any committee discussion on House Bill 306, additional or questions? Seeing none, Representative Wool, I'll entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 306 version 30-GH2815/A be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection to the motion as stated? Seeing none, the bill moves from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note. If you can all stick around until we adjourn and sign the paperwork, I want to actually just identify what we're going to be doing on our next meeting, Friday, February 23rd. We do have House Bill 340, repeal the BIDCO assistance program. It'll be our first hearing on that bill. House Bill 341, repealing the Athletic Commission boxing wrestling law, and that's our first hearing on that one. House Bill 342, land sale practices, also a first hearing. House Bill 343, premium finance companies exam requirements, first hearing. And then we have second hearings on House Bill 303, workers' compensation, and House Bill 346, dentists, and we do intend to move both of those. And so if you've had amendments, if they are not at my office, definitely check with me, and we'll see about getting them into the packet. And with that, I will adjourn House Labor and Commerce at 4:48 p.m. Thank you.